The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, Continued. His confrontation with Rayburn was apparently not as dramatic in fact as in the telling. Other members of the delegation and Texans familiar with its actions would later not recall any confrontation. When newspapermen, intrigued by the stories they were hearing, sought to learn if there was a split in the Texas delegation, its members were surprised. Their reaction was summed up by Albert Thomas of Houston, who said in reply to a reporter's question, "Of course, every member of the Texas delegation is for Vice President Garner, for president." When the Fort Worth Star-Telegram 2 days later sought to pin down members of the delegation as to whom they were supporting for president, Johnson's reply, echoing that of several other members, dodged the issue in a way that amounted to something less than a ringing repudiation of the vice president. "My esteem and regard for Vice President Garner, based upon 8 years' friendship, was clearly expressed in the resolution of the Texas delegation asserting our complete confidence in his honesty, integrity, and ability," he said. "Since the Vice President has not announced his desire to become a candidate for the President, I feel an announcement from a new congressman should await, not precede, his decision." Still, whatever the extent of Rayburn's entreaties or wrath, Johnson had resisted them. If there had been calculation behind his stand, he could see that Garner's day was over. A high form of political calculation, given the Vice President's popularity at the time. There was courage behind it, too. Given Rayburn's power and personality, considerable courage. And Johnson's portrayal of the confrontation was very convincing. By the time he had finished taking his story around the offices of key administration aides, he was something of a hero to the New Dealers. Most important, he had impressed and apparently won the liking of their chief, as was to be proven twice within the next month. On the first occasion, Roosevelt stepped into a dispute in Johnson's own district to protect the young congressman from Garner's wrath. "If a person wronged me," Garner was to say years later, "I never rested easy until I got even." Now Cactus Jack tried to get even with Lyndon Johnson. Still serving as postmaster in Austin was Buck Buchanan's appointee, Ewell Nally, a member of a family that had long been politically powerful in the city, and an old friend of Garner's. Even before the Lewis Garner explosion, as suspicions had begun to arise during the spring of 1939 about Johnson's attitude toward Garner's presidential aspirations, Nally had received instructions from Garner or Garner's allies to begin stirring up opposition to Johnson, opposition which could pose a threat to him when he had to run again in 1940, since the Austin postmaster controlled more than 200 jobs. Immediately after Johnson's recalcitrance over the Lewis resolution, reports from his district told Johnson that Nally was intensifying his opposition. During the spring, Johnson had personally asked Postmaster General Farley to fire Nally and replace him with his own nominee, Ray E. Lee, the former newsman whom he had hired to do public relations for the NYA. Farley's early benevolence toward an engaging congressional secretary had, however, vanished now that there were doubts about Johnson's loyalty to his old ally, Jack Garner. He told Johnson that enemies of Johnson had asked him not to fire Nally, and he declined to do so, citing a number of notably lame reasons to show that such a firing would be illegal. Johnson thereupon managed to have the matter brought to Roosevelt's attention by James Rowe, and the president in fact mentioned it to Farley after a cabinet meeting. But he did so only cursorily, and when Farley told him, "You can forget it," saying that the dismissal would be illegal, the president apparently did just that. He didn't pursue the matter. But that had been before the Lewis blast. About a week after it, Johnson raised the matter again, and this time Roosevelt promised to see that Nally was fired as soon as Congress adjourned. Adjournment brought no action, however, and with the president preparing to leave Washington on a vacation trip, Johnson was becoming increasingly agitated about the matter. On August 10th, overcoming Rowe's reluctance to pester the president, he prevailed on him to write a memo to Missy LaHand. "I don't know whether in the rush of getting away the president should be bothered about this, but Lyndon Johnson has been so insistent the past couple of days I will leave it up to your judgment. He says he will not and cannot go back to Texas until the president acts." When the memo was put before the president, it turned out that his inaction had only been due to oversight. Reminded of his promise, Roosevelt carried through on it, as firmly as even Johnson could have wished. Back to Rowe, in the President's hand, came the message. "Tell the post office that I want this done right away for Congressman Lyndon Johnson, that it is legal, and to send me the necessary papers. Tell Lyndon Johnson that I am doing it." Before the month was out, so was Nally, and Lee replaced him, thereby ending the threat to Johnson's re-election chances. In fact, he would be unopposed for re-election in 1940. During the month following the Lewis episode, Roosevelt not only protected Johnson, but tried to promote him. One of the subjects discussed when, through Charles Marsh, Johnson finally got the opportunity to talk personally to the president was the rural electrification program being carried out in his district. This was a matter of great interest to the president, and he was apparently impressed by Johnson's vivid description of the benefits that the Purdinalis Electric Cooperative had brought to hill country farmers, and by Johnson's claim, which would have startled officials of Texas Power and Light, enraged at what they viewed as the ruthless use of government power to bludgeon them into a surrender of their properties, that the program had been carried out with unprecedented cooperation between government and a private utility. On the day that Marsh and Johnson met with Roosevelt, Benjamin V. Cohen wrote the president that, "As you will see, Lyndon Johnson has done an admirable job working out the problems of Texas's little TVA. We are slowly building up a record to prove that cooperation between public and private power is not impossible, as Wilkie claims." With the post of REA administrator about to become vacant, Roosevelt added Johnson's name to the list of possible appointees. When the president asked the opinion of Henry Wallace, who of course had spent weekends at Longlea with Johnson, and who frequently relied on Marsh's advice, Wallace replied that, "I am so enthusiastic that I am quite ready to recommend his appointment. Lyndon has followed so closely the rural electrification program, has such zeal for it, is so well-rounded a New Dealer, and has such good judgment and general competence, that I think he will make an excellent selection." Immediately after the meeting of the Texas delegation at which Johnson carried out Roosevelt's wishes, it may have been at the Oval Office session at which Johnson regaled the president with his description of the delegation meeting, Roosevelt formally offered him the REA post. The offer was significant principally because it indicated the strength of the impression Johnson had made on Roosevelt once he got the chance to spend time with him. The directorship of a nationwide agency, particularly one as fast-growing and politically important as REA, was not the kind of job offered to many men still short of their 31st birthday. The REA post was, in addition, a particularly challenging job, as Roosevelt was well aware. He had 2 weeks earlier remarked to Ickes that it was difficult to find the right kind of man for administrator because the man had to be a builder and at the same time a finance man. However, there was not much chance that Johnson would accept the post. Previously an independent agency, REA was in the process of being transferred into the Agriculture Department so that its head would report not to the president but to a cabinet officer. Johnson understood where power came from in a democracy. "You have to be your own man," he had told Russell Brown years before. His own man, not someone else's, an elected official whose position had been conferred on him by voters, not by one man, who could, on a whim, take the position away. Hearing back in Austin about Roosevelt's offer, the wily Wirtz wired him, "Think you would be making a mistake, which you would afterwards regret for years if you act on proposition," warning Johnson in a follow-up letter that he might be sidetracked or shelved when you get out. Johnson immediately assured Wirtz that he needn't worry. Having fought his way at last onto the road that could lead him to achieve his ultimate ambition, he could not be persuaded by anyone, not even Franklin Roosevelt, to turn off it. "Dear Mr. President," he replied, "thanks for your offer to appoint me administrator of the REA. My own job now, however, is a contract with the people of the 10th District of Texas, which I hope to complete satisfactorily and to renew every 2 years as long as I appear useful." In a strikingly cordial reply, which, with Roosevelt's permission, Johnson released to the press, the president wrote back, "Dear Lyndon, I was very sorry that you did not feel that you wanted to accept the proffer of the administrator of the Rural Electrification Administration, but I do think I ought to tell you that very rarely have I known a proposed candidate for any position receive such unanimous recommendations from all sources as was the case with you. But I do understand the reasons why you felt that you should stay as a representative of your district. I congratulate the 10th District of Texas. Then he found a means of moving further along the road. The means was money. Herman Brown's money. All through 1939, of course, Johnson had been advancing Herman's interests, working diligently for the enlargement of the Marshall Ford Dam and for the profitable change orders on that project. The Browns were grateful. On May 2, 1939, George, who of course did nothing without clearing it with his older brother, wrote, "I hope you know, Lyndon, how I feel, reference to what you've done for me, and I'm going to try to show my appreciation through the years to come with actions rather than words, if I can find out when and where I can return at least a portion of the favors." The effort to find out when and where the favors could be returned continued. Before long, George would be writing Lyndon in response to a Johnson remark about the 96 old men in the Senate. "I have thought about you often out here, and don't know whether or not you've made up your mind about what future course you want to take, but someday in the next few years one of the old ones is going to pass on, and if you have decided to go that route, I think it would be grit to do it." No matter what the route, Johnson was assured in letters from Brown and Root headquarters on Calhoun Road in Houston, he could be certain of the firm's all-out support. In December of 1939, John Garner announced his presidential candidacy. He did so in a terse statement from Uvalde, and then, despite efforts to question him by reporters who had traveled hundreds of miles to do so, he left without another word on a week-long hunting trip with an old friend, a Uvalde garage mechanic. His supporters were more forthcoming. The facade that the vice president was running only because the president wasn't was stripped away. E.B. Germany, Garner's Texas state chairman, attacked Roosevelt directly, and Roy Miller's son Dale, already a considerable lobbyist in his own right, wrote in the Texas Weekly that, "regardless of what anyone may do, Mr. Garner will be a candidate, and he will be in the race to the finish." Garner's supporters, Miller wrote, have never believed that a president could prove so faithless to democratic principles as to seek a third term. But if Roosevelt should try to repudiate this cherished American principle, which is as embedded in our system of government as if it was written in the Constitution itself, Garner was going to stop him. Germany's speech closes the door to compromise. The Garner for President movement has cast the political die. To the president and the third-term apostles, it offers the olive branch of goodwill if they want it, and the club of resolute and relentless opposition if they don't. Martin Dies and other Garner supporters began using in public some of the words they had been using for years in private, in Dick Clayburgh's office, among other places. Railing against the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union and its president, David Dubinsky, spelled with an I at the end instead of a Y in the San Antonio Evening News, against organized labor in general and the National Labor Relations Board in particular, San Antonio Congressman Kilday said that socialists had infiltrated the Democratic Party, and that only a Garner victory would drive them out. As for the principals themselves, after a cabinet meeting in January 1940, Ickes used the words hatred and savage to describe a Roosevelt attack on Congress. In response, the vice president's face turned blood red and he retorted angrily. Then he accused the president of attacking our form of government. A Gallup poll that month revealed that Garner's popularity had not slipped. If Roosevelt did not run, he was the favorite of 58% of registered Democrats. And if Roosevelt did run? If president opposed vice president in Democratic primaries? The answer to that question seemed, in the first months of 1940, to be far from open and shut. With the economy sagging and unemployment remaining stubbornly high, with congressional opposition so strong that Roosevelt dared not introduce a single significant new program, and with the phony war muddying the international situation and all the president's diplomatic efforts thwarted, March 1940 was, as James McGregor Burns wrote, a low point even for Roosevelt's second term. On March 10th, the Washington Post stated that the Texan is believed to have a good chance to win when the two men clashed head-to-head in the California primary in May. For more than a year, Roosevelt had been pursuing a strategy that Burns calls broadening the field in order to prevent any candidate from getting too far ahead, hinting at support for Harry Hopkins or Paul McNutt, for example. The strategy had destroyed the hopes of all other candidates, but it hadn't even dented Garner's. Now the Democratic convention was close. Garner was immensely popular with many Democratic state bosses. If, when the convention began, his candidacy was still strong, several favorite Sun delegations, the Alabama delegation pledged to Speaker Bankhead, for example, would fall into line behind him. New Dealers concede that Garner, with Texas's 46 delegates, California's 44, some Wisconsin, Illinois, and probably a few scattered delegates in other states, will aggregate nearly 500 of the 551 delegates needed for nomination, the Washington Post reported. Even if this estimate was high, any substantial strength for Garner would do damage. As Burns puts it, Roosevelt's basic problem, if he chose to run, was not how to get the nomination. His ability to get a decisive convention majority was never in doubt, but how to be nominated in so striking a manner that it would amount to an emphatic and irresistible call to duty. This party call would be the prelude to a call from the whole country at election time. Only a party summons in July, in short, would make possible a popular summons in November. Standing formidably in the way of such a call was the very thing that made the call necessary, the anti-third-term tradition. All the polls showed a vast majority opposed to a third term as an abstract matter, and a clear majority opposed to a third term for Roosevelt. Roosevelt's task, in the event he finally decided to run, clearly was to bring about a unanimous party draft that would neutralize the anti-third-term sentiment. If the president were to run again, everything depended on a spontaneous draft. The chief obstacle to such a draft was John Garner. Were he to arrive in Chicago with a sizable block of votes, the Stop Roosevelt movement would be strong enough to preclude a draft. Garner had to be destroyed before the convention. Roosevelt's earlier inclination to put him on the defensive by attacking him in his home state hardened. Another consideration was expressed in Marsh's American Statesman. If Roy Miller selects the Texas delegation, such a delegation will be used as a trading block for the anti-New Deal group in the convention. New Dealers felt they had to try to at least cut into Garner's strength in the Texas delegation, place on it enough Roosevelt men to prevent it from being the convention's anti-Roosevelt rallying point. The odds against an attack in Texas succeeding, even in such limited objectives, were long, but the attempt had to be made. The decision was taken. Texas was to be made a battleground. But the battle required money. The state's size made radio the best means of rallying Roosevelt sentiment, but the cost of statewide radio hookups was substantial by 1940 standards. Even local rallies were expensive. The price of the permit necessary to hold a rally at the Dallas Fairgrounds, for example, was $300, and the incidental expenses of such a rally might run some $1,000 more, even without figuring in the cost of newspaper advertising to attract a crowd. Such costs were multiplied by the system under which the state's delegation to the National Convention would be chosen. The delegates would be selected at a state Democratic convention. The delegates to this convention would be selected by conventions in all of the state's 254 counties. And the delegates to these county conventions would be selected at precinct conventions, thousands of them, which would be held throughout the state on May 4th. Money could play a decisive role in a precinct convention, which might consist of no more than a few handfuls of persons. Anyone who had voted in the last election was eligible to attend. Gathered in a school or firehouse. Just finding out who was eligible cost money. The names of voters in the previous election were listed in the office of the county tax assessor, but these lists had to be purchased. Then there was the problem of finding out which of the eligible voters favored your candidate. This was generally accomplished by telephone calls from a popular local politician or politician's wife. You'd go to a county clerk's wife and say, "You're not doing anything. How about taking the $75 or $100 and calling some people?" recalls Harold H. Young, a burly, brilliant, idealistically liberal attorney who was in charge of the Roosevelt campaign in Dallas and Fort Worth. Then, in Young's words, "It was a matter of who got your folks, voters who favored your candidate, out to the precinct convention. Direct mailings, which cost money from mimeographing and stamps, were used, and of course, on the evening of the convention, automobiles, with their drivers given gasoline and expense money, were needed. The amount required for a single precinct was not large, but with thousands of precincts, the total required was considerable." The Garner campaign in Texas, of course, had all the money it needed. the utilities, the railroads, the major oil companies such as the Humboldt and the Magnolia, with great ranchers and lumbermen and cotton families. The state's monolithic establishment that had long dominated its politics, largely through the use of financial pressure, were united behind the candidacy of the man who had long stood as its symbol. And as soon as the Garner forces realized, to their astonishment and rage, that Cactus Jack was to be challenged on their home ground, they mobilized in what the Dallas Morning News called the most painstaking preparations in recent Texas political history. The Roosevelt campaign's shortage of funds was, in contrast, acute. Because of his personal friction with the president, and because he was planning to concentrate his political contributions behind the vice presidential campaign of frequent Longley guest Wallace, Charles Marsh's support for FDR was largely confined to editorials. When Garner State Chairman Myron Blaylock declared, "Even here in Texas there are those small voices who speak out against this distinguished son of the Lone Star State," Young, a gifted political strategist, saw an opening. He wanted to reply, "That's true. Nobody's for FDR except small voices, the people." But because Young had no money, his rejoinder went unheard. Blaylock had spoken on a statewide radio hookup. Young couldn't afford even a local broadcast. Garner, Young reported, had a paid worker in every precinct in Dallas. The Roosevelt forces didn't have a paid worker in any precinct. Maury Maverick was leading the third-term forces in San Antonio, but was all but helpless against the massive outpouring of Garner money in that city. But Lyndon Johnson was to produce a source of funds. Success had not diminished Sherman Brown's ambitions. His car still roared endlessly back and forth across Texas as he pushed his projects and searched out new work, so that Lyndon Johnson sometimes had difficulty locating him to make his reports. He would send copies of telegrams to two or three towns at once to make sure one of them reached Brown. And even the giant Marshall Ford Dam had not lessened his obsession to build giant projects. Now, moreover, the great dam was almost completed. A score of smaller jobs would not enable him to keep on the payroll the organization he had built up with so much effort, and of which he was so proud. Herman Brown wanted, and needed, something big. Something very big was on the horizon. In 1938, Congress, at President Roosevelt's request, had authorized the expenditure of $1 billion on a two-ocean navy. By early 1939, it had become clear that a substantial portion of that billion would be spent on the construction of naval bases and training stations for a greatly expanded Navy Air Force. On April 26, 1939, Roosevelt had signed into law a bill authorizing the expenditure of $66,800,000 for the first of such bases. Brown's attention was already focused on the Navy because Lyndon Johnson was a member of the Naval Affairs Committee. He decided to bid on one of the bases in San Juan, Puerto Rico, authorized in the April bill. In April 1939, however, Lyndon Johnson still had not yet gained entree to the president, and his attempt to give Brown and Root a helping hand was rebuffed in a manner suitable to what he was, a congressman without influence. Within 2 days of the signing of the Naval Air Base Bill, he had to confess to George Brown that, "I talked with Admiral Morrill," Vice Admiral Ben Morrill, in charge of the Navy's shore construction program, "and he said there's nothing further that we can do at this time." On May 16th, he promised George, "I'll do all I can to get you any information on the Puerto Rico project, and will let you know when anything breaks," but added, "You know how hard it is to get any dope in advance," the statement of a man not on the inside of decisions. Seeking to offset its lack of experience in areas of construction required by this job, Brown and Root took as a partner on its Puerto Rico proposal the W.S. Bellows Construction Company of Houston, and submitted a bid, but the firm was shown no favoritism, as George Brown noted in a letter to Johnson, which stated, "I got some inquiries from the Naval Department for additional data," but added that these inquiries have apparently been sent to all prospective contractors. The entree to the president that Johnson gained thereafter may have entitled him to help on a postmastership and the offer of the REA post. It did not involve any say in the awarding of a huge federal contract. As Johnson learned when, after another firm was awarded the contract in November, he demanded an explanation from Morrill. The Admiral brushed him off by sending him a memo from a lower-ranking officer. Pursuant to your inquiry relative to the reason why Brown and Root Incorporated, NWS Bellows Company, were not selected as the contractors for the San Juan Air Base project, while both firms had extensive construction experience, they had no experience whatsoever in the type of construction necessary to build a naval air base. A naval air base and training station had been proposed for Texas, on the Gulf at Corpus Christi, in the mid-1930s, and indeed its construction had been recommended by the Navy in September 1938. The city's congressman, Richard Clayburgh, and South Texas's most influential figure in Washington, Roy Miller, had been actively pushing for the project for more than 3 years. But Clayburgh's family was a major Garner financial backer, and Roy Miller was Garner's campaign manager. Herman Brown had been interested in the Corpus Christi base from the first, but he was a Garner financial backer, as indeed was fitting, since his views on organized labor, on the balanced budget, and on communists, socialists, and liberals were indistinguishable from the vice president's. "From what I see in the papers," his brother George happily wrote Roy Miller in May 1939, "things seem to be moving along all right for the VP." Other big Texas contractors who might have been considered for the job were also identified with Garner, or with Reconstruction Finance Corporation head Jesse Jones of Houston, of whose oft-professed loyalty to the New Deal Roosevelt had become, correctly, suspicious. After Clayburgh had been making optimistic predictions for months, he had to admit in September 1939 that "there has been no intimation as to whether it is intended to build the training station here in Corpus Christi in 2 years or 15. The Navy's construction program, surging ahead in other locations, remained stalled in Texas. As late as January 9, 1940, O'Reill told a House subcommittee that the Corpus Christi project was not viewed as emergent. Testimony that led the subcommittee to reject even a $50,000 request for making surveys of the proposed base site. Close as he and George Brown had become, Lyndon Johnson may have shied away from suggesting frankly, even to him, what he felt Brown and Root should do. In October 1939, with the Corpus Christi base still not included on the list of the Navy's preferred projects, George wrote him, "I've been sitting here all week waiting to hear from you. I felt that you had something on your mind last week, but did not get around to getting it off." But George may have figured it out for himself. He ended this letter by writing, "In the past, I have not been very timid about asking you to do favors for me, and hope you will not get any timidity if you have anything at all that you think I can or should do. Remember that I am for you, right or wrong, and it makes no difference if I think you are right or wrong. If you want it, I'm for it 100%. Opposing John Garner would be a huge gamble for a Texas contractor, but it would not be the largest gamble ever taken by Herman Brown, not for the man who had mortgaged everything he had accumulated in 20 years of terribly hard work, to begin work on a dam before it had been authorized. And this new gamble, if successful, would give him the chance to build something even bigger than the dam, and to make even bigger money building it. A signal went out. In Houston, where Brown and Root's headquarters were located, Herman Brown's political influence was growing, and the city's congressman, Albert Thomas, a junior representative with negligible clout in Washington, was known to take Herman's orders unquestioningly. In August, Congressman Thomas had said, "Of course every member of the Texas delegation is for Vice President Garner." Now, in December 1939, Thomas made another statement. He was not for Garner after all, he said. He was for Roosevelt. That signal from Texas was answered by several signals from Washington, from the White House. They involved Lyndon Johnson and Brown and Root. The first, on January 2, 1940, was a public signal, a presidential appointment. The post involved was a major one, Under Secretary of the Interior. The appointee would be second in command only to Harold Ickes in the giant department. It went to a Texan. "The choicest plum handed out to a Texan in years," said the Houston press. And the Texan it went to was Alvin J. Wirtz, who was not only an attorney for Brown and Root, but was identified with Lyndon Johnson. Lest this latter connection be overlooked, the the White House went out of its way to point it out, Presidential Secretary Early stating that Representative Lyndon B. Johnson presented Wirtz's name, and letting reporters know further that, as the press reported, neither Texas senator was consulted, nor was Sam Rayburn or Jesse Jones. To readers of Political Signals, therefore, it was clear that Lyndon Johnson had become a key White House ally, perhaps the key White House ally, in Texas. In White House inner circles, it was also quickly made clear that the man appointed at Johnson's suggestion was going to play a major role in the Roosevelt campaign in Texas. Roosevelt told us that Garner had to be sent home permanently to his 6,000 neighbors in Uvalde, Texas, so that he could add to his millions, presidential aide David K. Niles says. And this crucial task went to Alvin Wirtz. The Roosevelt campaign in Texas was shortly to be beefed up by the appointment of another Johnson supporter, Austin attorney Everett L. Looney, as Assistant United States Attorney General. Another signal from the White House was private. The Navy Department was quietly informed that Lyndon Johnson was to be consulted, and his advice taken, on the awarding of Navy contracts in Texas. Following this signal, a number of Texans flew up to Washington. One was Herman Brown. Another was Edward A. Clark, who had left his post as Texas Secretary of State to go on retainer for Brown and Root and to begin using his political acumen on Herman Brown's behalf. Still another was an old Brown associate whose qualification for this trip was his ability to know where political money could most profitably be distributed in Texas, Claude Wilde Sr. While he was in Washington, Herman may have been handed a letter written by Roosevelt. Its contents are not known. No copy of it can be found. The only reference to it comes in a February 9, 1940 letter from Lyndon Johnson to George Brown, noting that Herman came in last night, which states, "Am enclosing the President's letter." After Herman's trip to Washington, two alterations in the status quo quickly became apparent. First, Brown and Root was, in obtaining coveted Navy Department contracts, no longer just one of a crowd. The Corpus Christi Naval Air Station, not emergent in January, in February was moved abruptly, if quietly, onto the preferred list of Navy construction projects with the highest priority. The contract for the airbase, which it was now decided would be of the cost-plus type, so profitable to contractors, was not, it was also decided, to be put out for competitive bidding, but was to be awarded on a negotiated basis. The only firm with which serious negotiations were held turned out to be Brown and Root. The firm's lack of experience in airbase construction, which less than 3 months before had kept it from getting a contract for a similar base, was no longer mentioned. Because the contract was so big, Brown and Root was to be required to share the profits, if not the work, with another contractor, who had a long association with the New Deal. The White House said we had to take in Henry Kaiser, George Brown recalls. But when George arrived in Washington during either the last week in March or the first week in April to work out the details of Kaiser's participation, Ben Moreel said, "You don't have to give him half." Moreel probably intended Kaiser's share to be only slightly smaller than half, but the vagueness of the Admiral's instructions gave Brown and Root leeway, and Herman told George how to take advantage of that leeway. Meeting with Kaiser at the Shoreham Hotel, George Brown, an unknown Texas contractor, showed the famous industrialist, famous among other reasons for his toughness in negotiations, a little Texas toughness. I offered him 25%. He said, "That's an insult." I said, "Henry, we don't need you. We don't need your organization." So we sat around and talked, and then I said, "Well, I have to be going." He said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "I already told you what I'm going to do." And 25% was all Kaiser got. To keep Kaiser's participation in the profits secret, Kaiser's participation in the work itself was almost nil, his share was in the name of the Columbia Inspection Company. The Bellows firm was also a participant. "We needed someone who had done buildings," Brown explains. "We hadn't done many." To keep other contractors from becoming interested, preparations for the Corpus Christi project were carried on in secrecy. Blueprints and specifications were drawn up by the Navy, not in Texas, but in Pensacola, Florida. By the time the imminent building of the base was made public, drawings and specifications were almost complete, and it was revealed hundreds of acres of the land needed on Flower Bluff, a point of land at the tip of Corpus Christi Bay, were already under option. Plans for the base became public knowledge on May 15th, when the House Naval Affairs Committee opened hearings on a bill that would provide funds for 12 new naval air bases. The Corpus Christi base would be by far the largest, almost twice as large as any of the others. And there were other differences between this and the other bases, most notably the speed with which, now that the plans were public, they were finalized. After a meeting with President Roosevelt, Committee Chairman Vinson announced that, because of the urgency of the project, Corpus Christi would be the only one of the 12 bases for which funds would be provided immediately, in the appropriations bill itself. Funding for the other bases would have to wait for the later passage of a deficiency appropriations bill. Lyndon Johnson told the Corpus Christi caller that the bill would be reported favorably and acted on in the House before the end of the week. That rush schedule was met, and within two more weeks the bill had been passed by the Senate. Shortly after noon on June 13, 1940, President Roosevelt signed a contract for the construction of the base on a cost-plus fixed-fee basis. According to the Corpus Christi caller, it was the first cost-plus fixed-fee contract Roosevelt had personally signed. The contract fixed a price of $23,381,000 for the base, with the contractors to be paid an additional $1.2 million for doing the work. Even as these figures were being announced, however, those connected with the project knew they would shortly be altered. In fact, before the end of the year, the authorized cost of the project would be quietly increased to nearly $30 million. In February 1941, the appropriation was increased twice, first by an additional $13 million and then by $2 million more, raising the cost to $45 million. Each increase, of course, carried with it a proportionate increase in the contractor's fee. By this time, other contractors, some of them politically well-connected themselves, were anxious to obtain part of the job, but, says Tommy Corcoran, a close friend of the Undersecretary of the Navy in charge of such contracts, James V. Forrestal, "Mr. Forrestal twisted a hell of a lot of tails to keep the work in the hands of Lyndon's friends, Brown and Root." As war clouds gathered and then broke in thunder, and the need for trained flyers and for facilities to train them became more urgent, the increases in funding for the base grew larger. Appropriations for the Corpus Christi base soared to more than $100 million. The second alteration that followed Herman Brown's trip to Washington was that the Roosevelt for President campaign in Texas was no longer short of cash. March 4, 1940, 3:30. LBJ delivered $300 in cash to Morey on the floor today. JBC. $300 was a minor item in that campaign. Harold Young, who a week or two before had been so short of funds for running the campaign in Dallas, was shortly able to report, "I've rented a room at the Adolphus Hotel at $45 per month, have hired the stenographer for $25 a week, and I have put a publicity man to work at $100 per week. Beginning tomorrow, I expect to run a small ad in the Dallas News each day, asking those who believe in Roosevelt to write me. We are rapidly building up a precinct organization which will be sufficient to overpower all opposition by May 4th. Building up a precinct organization cost money, but the money was available, thanks largely to Herman Brown. Even as the fight in Texas was being joined, however, the reason for it was fading away. 1939 may have been John Garner's year. 1940, the year that mattered, was Franklin D. Roosevelt's. March was indeed a low point for the president, but although he remained silent as to his intentions, the fox was ready to leave his lair. He had stuck his nose out, in fact, on February 24th. That was the last day on which the president could have forbidden the entering of his name in Illinois, whose primary would be held on April 9th, and he had not done so. The name of Franklin D. Roosevelt was going to be on a primary ballot. And with every increase in international tension, Americans became increasingly aware that they might soon be at war, and it became more and more evident that the Democratic Convention would select to lead the nation through war the man who had led it through the Depression. Politicians began backing away from Garner's candidacy. Observing him at a dinner in Washington, Ickes gloated that all his buoyancy seemed to have deserted him. He looked glum and unhappy and did very little talking. I suppose there is no doubt that he realizes he is in for a terrific beating at the hands of the president. His fears were confirmed on April 2nd in Wisconsin, where he had once expected to win most of the delegates. Instead, he suffered a smashing defeat. Then at dawn on April 9th, the day of the Illinois primary, German troops struck across the defenseless Danish border, and German destroyers and troop ships suddenly loomed out of a snowstorm off the coast of Norway, torpedoing Norwegian gunboats as troops poured ashore. Denmark was overrun in a matter of hours. Norway's main ports were all in Nazi hands. The phony war was over. Roosevelt defeated Garner in Illinois by 8-1. Garner was finished on April 9th, and he knew it. If he hadn't known it, clues were promptly furnished. As columnist Ray Tucker wrote, "The most downhearted man on Capitol Hill is Vice President John Nance Garner. His friends have deserted him, left him cold." When Jack was riding high, his office was the gathering place of senators. They rushed in every hour of the day to seek advice or to toss off a quick drink. But his office is no longer a magnet for the politicos. The most popular vehicle on Capitol Hill these days is the third-term bandwagon. Refusing to bow out of the race, Garner said defiantly that his name would be presented to the convention if only as a gesture. But a gesture was all it would be. Although Texas's precinct conventions would be held on May 4th, the primary itself, the last in the country, would not be held until May 27th, by which time primaries in other states would have completely eliminated him as a threat to Roosevelt. Roosevelt appears to have seen this, and also to have seen and accepted that while he might crush Garner everywhere else, he could not defeat him in his home state, and he now decided not to wage an all-out war against Garner in Texas. The loudest of the voices for Roosevelt, Maverick, was abruptly silenced. His statements against the vice president ceased, reportedly on a suggestion directly from the president. Near the end of March, Roosevelt had told Ickes that he does not want any fight made for Roosevelt delegates in Texas. He thinks the Texans are unusually full of state pride, and that they would resent an outside candidate coming in, even if that candidate were the president himself. He had already sent word to others in Texas not to fight for delegates. At the end he became realistic and, with a smile, said, "Of course, it is not well to go into a fight unless we know that we can win." But while the president's reason for fighting Garner in Texas had faded, that of Johnson and Wirtz had not, and they apparently persuaded the president that the fight should go on. During the first week in April, the tall, eager young congressman and his calm, cigar-smoking advisor made a series of visits to the White House. What they said is not known, but one aspect of the situation was revealing. In Texas, politicians knew that Garner's popularity, coupled with his control of the party apparatus, gave Roosevelt no chance to win the delegation. In Washington, 1,600 miles away, where Texas sentiment was reported to the White House primarily by Johnson and Wirtz, the impression was given that the president had a good chance of taking the delegation and completing his enemy's humiliation. Johnson and Wirtz also may have appealed to other sides of the president's character. This book is continued on cassette number 3, side 1.